This is Network Europe.
Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest,
Coming up in the program, nationalists in Turkey react to this year's Nobel Literature Prize announcement. With elections in the Netherlands just a month away, we speak exclusively to Prime Minister Jan-Peter Balkenende.
It is important in a tolerant society as the Netherlands that there is a place for everybody, that there is mutual respect among the religions.
Who should foot the bill for an oil spill on the Danube River and violence on the rise again in Paris's poverty-stricken outer suburbs? These stories and more in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. At the helm today, I'm Mark Cummins. Thanks for joining the program. Coming up, why Turkish nationalists are angry over this year's Nobel Prize in Literature. But first, it's election season in Europe over the next few months. Sweden went to the polls last month. France's presidential race is not far off in 2007, and the Dutch elections are just a month away. For Prime Minister Jan-Peter Balkenende, the timing could hardly be better. His Christian Democrats are rising in the polls and are now at a dead heat with the opposition Labour Party. Mr. Balkenende has ushered the Netherlands through a rocky period since his first election campaign in 2002, a period that included two political assassinations and a premature collapse of his two cabinets. In an exclusive interview, Radio Netherlands' Richard Walker asked the Prime Minister what he thinks his party's chances are in the upcoming elections.
If you look to the polls in the Netherlands, you can say that the position of the Labour Party, the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats is comparable at the moment. But we are now at the start of the campaign. And many things can happen during the next weeks. In any case, I'm very happy with the results of our policy. If you look to the situation of the Netherlands at this moment, you can draw the conclusion that the position now is stronger than 4 years ago. We were walking behind in 2002 compared to other countries. If you look to, let's say, the economy, the employment, the budget household of the state. And today, the figures are much, much better. If you look to, let's say, the trust among people and among consumers and investors, things have changed enormously. So that's a good story to tell, but of course it's not a guarantee.
The voice of non-native voters is crucial in this election campaign, isn't it? We've seen that with the recent controversy over the Armenian genocide. What are you doing to reassure those voters and win their confidence?
Very important at the moment is that those people do have the impression that they are really part of Dutch society, that the Christian Democrats have a story to tell that is very relevant to them. That means that you have to look to the problems they are confronted with. By example, if you look to young people with a Turkish or Moroccan background, sometimes it's very difficult for them to get a job. So we have to find the right answers for their questions and their problems. If you look to the role of religion, you know I'm a Christian, but it is important in a tolerant society as the Netherlands is that there is place for everybody, that there is mutual respect among the religions, and that people do have the feeling we are part of this society and we can participate in it. So that will be the message I will give to the people, and I really hope that they also will look to my party.
The full-face Muslim veil on women. Yesterday, British Prime Minister Tony Blair leapt into this debate by calling it a mask of separation. What's your impression of it?
If you look to the clothes people are wearing, you have to admit that Muslim people, of course, have their own things to wear. I think you have to respect it. Only if it's impossible to see each other, that's a discussion now about the burqa, that you only can see the eyes. I think then I have problems with it, because you cannot communicate. But
Would you ask a woman to remove it before speaking?
Well, at this moment, it is, I think, not really a big problem. Of course, you can talk in general about these elements, but it is not a very sensitive issue at the moment. The only thing we say is if you have some responsibilities that you have, by example, you have to wear a uniform, then, of course, you cannot do it. If you work for courts in the Netherlands, by example, then you can do it. But please, I think it's important that we give the room for people to clothe in the way they like it.
Because I imagine voters are looking particularly at the words that you're using to talk about the situation at the moment, because we were talking about non-native voters earlier on.
Yeah.
These issues are becoming more and more sensitive at the moment, given that the Muslim community is feeling under the spotlight, as it were.
Yeah, and that's the reason why I say it is important that we have discussions with each other, that there is also room for diversity, for religious plurality, and also as far as the clothes are concerned, we have to take into account also that element. It's a matter of having mutual respect in a society. And I think that's also a characteristic of Dutch society. We always have been an open and tolerant society. And I think that's also the answer for the 23rd century in my country.
Radio Netherlands' Richard Walker with that exclusive interview with the Dutch Prime Minister, looking for a fourth term for his Christian Democrat-led coalition at the polls on November the 22nd. You're listening to Network Europe. Last week, Turkey received its first Nobel Prize winner, with Orhan Pamuk winning the prize for literature. But surprisingly, his award has not been met with universal celebration in Turkey. The writer has become the target of the country's growing nationalist movement, which consider him a traitor. That's because Pamuk has frequently spoken out about the killing of Armenians in Turkey 90 years ago. To make matters worse for the author, on the day of the announcement of his Nobel Prize, the French Parliament passed a bill which criminalizes the denial of the Armenian genocide, something Turkey strongly denies. The two events have placed Pamuk at the center of the perfect nationalist storm. Deutsche Welle Radio's Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
With arms linked, hundreds of right-wing nationalist protesters marched up Istanbul's main shopping street in the city center. Chanting the ominous warning, "Our patience is ending," the protesters frightened some shoppers who darted into shops to make way for the angry mob. The march ends outside the French consulate, where nationalist supporters placed a black wreath. But their anger wasn't only aimed at France for passing a bill criminalizing the denial of the Armenian genocide in 1915. According to one of the protest organizers, Turkey has a traitor in its midst.
Around the same time as the French bill was introduced, the Nobel Prize for Literature was given to Orhan Pamuk, who had insulted the Turkish nation by saying, "Turks massacred 1.5 million Armenians." This is no coincidence. A world propaganda war is being waged against Turkey, and people like Orhan Pamuk are supporting it. We, the Turkish people, will crush this threat.
Controversy has followed Orhan Pamuk throughout his career. The 55-year-old was the first author in the Muslim world to publicly condemn the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. In the past, the wider Turkish public would have dismissed such angry denouncements by Turkey's extreme right. But this time, many of the onlookers here in Istanbul cheered and applauded the protest against France and anger directed against Pamuk. One of those cheering onlookers is sales representative Hassan.
"We never make genocide in this land, never. Never, I'm just telling truth. They're just making politics. They're just showing us the world. We are bad people, we love the genocide, we love the kill. Yeah, they're just showing the people like that. This is why I'm angry, you know."
After the protests had dispersed, I spoke to people to find out what they felt about Turkey's first Nobel laureate. For a country which normally prides itself on international success, there was little support for Pamuk. The overwhelming majority of people canvassed expressed views such as Hassan, a teacher.
"I'm not happy because it's not about the Turkish people. It's just about Orhan Pamuk. I don't agree with him. I read his books. I don't like him very much because he is against the Turkish citizens. Maybe he takes voice from the European Union."
The European Union is increasingly a term of disgust for many Turks. Growing public opposition in Europe towards Turkey's EU bid, along with relentless criticisms by Brussels over Ankara's lack of reforms, support among Turks for EU membership is at a record low of below 50%. Soli Özel is an international relations expert at Istanbul's Bilgi University. He's not surprised by the display of anger aimed at both Pamuk and France. Özel argues the French Parliament's vote could not have come at a worse time.
"This will further inflame the fires of anti-Europeanism, anti-Westernism, nationalism, we already have a climate of elections in this country. As we enter the last year till the next regularly scheduled elections. And I think the government will be hard-pressed to respond to that pressure rather than try to calm it down.
Özal's fears seem well-founded. The Turkish president, Ahmet Necdet Sezer, refused to congratulate Pamuk or even comment on the Nobel Prize. And while Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan did welcome the award, the Speaker of the Turkish Parliament, Bülent Arınç, was more circumspect and acknowledge the public anger.
Given the debate that this has caused, Pamuk should act prudently from now on. We are waiting to see what he says because his comments will guide society.
One man who's not waiting for Pamuk's statement is Kemal Kerençsiz. He's a leading figure of the far right. Kerençsiz has made his name by exploiting the country's laws to open scores of cases against Turkey's liberal writers and journalists, including Pamuk, for articles and statements they've made. Europe, in turn, reacted by condemning Turkey for the lack of freedom of expression. But Kerençsiz has no regrets and says Turkey is threatened by Europe and its supporters like Pamuk.
A large part of society here thinks that this Nobel Prize is very dubious. Only a small intellectual group thinks he got it for his writing. This award is a reward for the lies he writes about the so-called genocide. His work has nothing to do with Turkish values, but with the old rotten ideas of the West. That's why he was awarded the Nobel Prize. It's all part of Europe's plot to partition Turkey, like they did 90 years ago. They want to give our land to the Armenians, the Kurds, and the Greeks. Pamuk and the Europeans he loves so much are the enemies of Turkey. But today, more and more Turks are now seeing the danger Europe poses and are making their voices heard.
Kerençsiz is also preparing to file a case against the Nobel Academy for Pamuk's award. Once dismissed as an oddball extremist, people like Kerençsiz are now increasingly winning the ear of the Turkish public. As Turkey's EU membership bid continues to falter, support for the right is predicted to rise. Next month, Brussels is due to publish what is widely expected to be a highly critical report on Turkey's membership bid. Such are the concerns over Turkey, many European politicians and commissioners are warning that the whole process could grind to a halt, if not collapse. For authors such as Orhan Pamuk and others who argue for understanding and social reform, even a Nobel Prize does not guarantee their message will be heard. The growing feeling in Turkey is that the country stands at a crossroads. But which road it chooses could well be determined in Brussels. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
Coming up, who should pay the bill for the cleanup of a 50-kilometre oil slick on Europe's Danube River? You're listening to Network Europe. Almost a year after France's suburban riots, police are warning of a new upsurge in violence in the country's poorer districts. Police were stoned and beaten by gangs of youths in three separate incidents over the past 3 weeks. In the latest one, officers were ambushed and had to fire their hand weapons into the air to escape. The growing defiance against law enforcement authorities is a sign that few lessons have been drawn from last year's troubles on both sides, and that little has been done to improve the lives of immigrants in France's derelict and isolated housing estates. Radio France International's Nick Champeur reports from the town of Clichy-sous-Bois, from where the first sparks of violence were ignited a year ago.
A heavy-handed police identity check in one of France's deprived suburbs during last year's riots. 1 year on, relations between youth and police have not budged an inch, and police are raising the alarm. Gérard Mazy is a 34-year-old officer. He is married with two children. He works in Sevran in northern Paris. He and his colleagues are afraid of patrolling in the dense and run-down housing estates there.
Everywhere we go, they throw stones at us. Any kind of projectile, metal drain covers, bits of steel the size of cannonballs, old bicycles that they throw from the fourth or the eighth or the tenth floor. When that happens, all we can do is leave. That's not what our job is supposed to be. My wife is afraid. It's a fact. As soon as you put your uniform on, you're in danger.
Gérard Mazzi complains that there are even blogs on the internet explaining the best way to ambush policemen. Last week, three of Gérard's colleagues were ambushed in the suburb of Épinay-sur-Seine. One was hospitalized, requiring 30 stitches on his face. In Clichy-sous-Bois, 10 kilometers west of Sevran, teenagers just hanging out near the town hall say the police are getting what they deserve. Manu and Omar are both 15. They say they're constantly hassled and that officers show no respect and even beat them on occasion. That's why Omar says when we see policemen, we throw rocks at them. There are no police headquarters in Clichy-sous-Bois, a high immigration suburb where the crime rate is high. This means that riot police and anti-crime units are brought in from other areas. Samir Mihi says that's part of the problem. It's actually why Bouna and Zied decided to hide in an electricity power generator when they saw the police on October the 27th, 2005.
C'est la police de proximité, une police avec,
The solution is neighborhood policing, where officers know the locals well and where citizens know and recognize local police officers. That's why Bouna and Zied decided to escape and hide when they saw the police, because they didn't know how the ID check would end. They'd heard lots of stories of friends getting beaten up during ID checks or in custody, so they were afraid. Bouna and Zied were half an hour away from breaking the fast, but it's their lives that were broken at the end, and those of their relatives.
Samir's organization, Au-delà des mots, will be releasing a hip-hop album next month to pay tribute to Bouna and Zied. The main single is called Dead for Nothing. The tragic death of Bouna and Zied sparked off riots in Clichy-sous-Bois and led to repeated overnight violence across the nation over a period of 3 weeks, during which thousands of cars were torched. They have raised awareness over France's ghettos, but little has changed in Clichy-sous-Bois. Olivier Klein is the town's deputy mayor.
Dans le quotidien des Clichois,
very little has changed in the daily lives of people here. And that's the point, because it's the poverty of families who feel that they've been abandoned. If we start addressing society's problems and solve unemployment, lack of transport, and the housing shortage in our suburbs, then there will be ever fewer clashes between police and our youth.
The problem is that it takes time to fix a suburb, so to speak. There is no suburban train station in Clichy-sous-Bois, not a single job center, despite unemployment topping the 40% mark. It also takes time to destroy derelict buildings and erect new ones. So, to restore pride and confidence in the short term, the city council has invited world-famous photographers and locals to take pictures of their town. The exhibition is called Clichy sans cliché, or Clichy without clichés.
Elle montre la réalité, mais elle montre aussi,
It shows the harsh reality of life here, but also people on their way to work, kids going to school, people getting married, and so on. The aim of the exhibition was to restore a sense of pride in being from Clichy-sous-Bois, and I think we have succeeded. Thanks to these pictures, these very often beautiful pictures.
À travers ces photos qui sont souvent magnifiques.
The council has enlarged the giant, beautiful and colorful pictures all over the town, on billboards, building walls and so on. But these fail to conceal the cracks of the buildings and the divide in society. Clichy-sous-Bois, Nick Champeau, RFI.
You're listening to Network Europe, a co-production of Europe's international broadcasters. Next up, we move east to a mystery 50-kilometer-long oil slick that was recently investigated by Romanian and Bulgarian authorities along the Danube River, one of Europe's most important environmental and economic riverways. Eventually, oil installations upriver at Prahovo in Serbia were discovered to be behind the release of an undetermined quantity of heating oil. In less than a week, the Romanian authorities managed to clean up the oil from a 50-kilometer stretch of the river. Fortunately, the damage to the environment was minimal. But now the question is, who should foot the €300,000 cleanup bill? Radio Romania International's Julian Murisan reports that the lack of transborder environmental legislation in countries outside the EU renders these kinds of issues even thornier than they already are.
Romania shares the Danube River with four of its neighboring countries. In the last 6 years, Romania entered into conflict on environmental grounds with three of them: Serbia, Ukraine, and Hungary. Back in 2000, an Australian mining company in northwestern Romania caused a major cyanide spill that poisoned several rivers in Hungary and 2,000 kilometers of the Danube. Hungary unsuccessfully claimed damages from Romania. It's only now that the legislation void is being filled. Gheorghe Constantin, head of the Water Management Department of the Romanian Ministry of the Environment.
It was a legal dispute between the Hungarian government and the company. It was not the responsibility of the states. Right now, the European countries are developing a legal instrument concerning the responsibility of the states. It was not possible in 2000 for the Hungarian state to act against the Romanian state.
At the heart of the most recent environmental conflict was a 50-kilometer-long oil slick on the Danube, caused by a Serb oil facility a couple of weeks ago. Romania managed the situation quite well, mitigating the effects of the spill. There were no dead fish and the flora was not affected. Bucharest also jumped to help Bulgaria by donating absorbent materials and floating booms. It all cost Bucharest some 300,000 euros. Minister of Environment Sulfina Barbu hopes to get the money back from the Serb company.
The Serbian Minister of the Environment has taken a fair stand, as he has officially acknowledged that the polluter is a Serb company. Serbia is an EU aspirant country, so it will apply the EU legislation, which says that the polluter pays the damages.
Yes, but Serbia is not an EU member state. Romania will join soon, but it takes two to solve a conflict. Therefore, we can only hope that Serbia's European aspirations will help smooth things between the two parties.
Radio Romania International's Julian Mursan with that report. You're listening to Network Europe. Talks between the EU and its biggest neighbour, Russia, have been taking place this week. Our Brussels correspondent Stephen Castle filed this report.
First a crisis over relations with Georgia, then a row over human rights and the murder of a campaigning journalist. Russia, the giant on the EU's doorstep, has barely been out of the news recently. Oil-rich, truculent and in possession of a nuclear arsenal, Russia is hardly an easy interlocutor for the EU. It has lived under the Tsars and then the Communists, but has yet to make the transition to a full liberal democracy. Diplomats in Brussels know just how hard Moscow can be to deal with. In the first half of the decade, it took the European Commission years to negotiate an agreement on transport links to Kaliningrad. Formerly known as Königsberg, Kaliningrad became a Russian enclave surrounded by EU territory. During these talks, officials discovered that Russia is not afraid of throwing its weight around. Moscow is also adept at exploiting the EU's lack of internal cohesion by playing one national capital off against another. At various points in time, Tony Blair, Jacques Chirac and Gerhard Schröder have all been courted by President Putin. But undoubtedly, Russian foreign policy is now more assertive than at any time in recent years. For this, there are two reasons. The first is the high price of energy. With demand for oil and gas soaring, Russia, with its massive natural resources, finds itself in the driving seat. European nations need Russian energy, and Germany in particular has negotiated a special deal to the annoyance of its neighbour Poland. Moscow knows it can call the shots. When the EU asked Russia to open its energy pipeline network to use by Western importers, it has scant hope of success. The second reason is that in the international diplomatic stakes, Moscow feels confident enough to make its presence felt. That is because the world's only real superpower, the US, finds itself hamstrung. Bogged down in a war in Iraq, the US President George Bush is limited in his ability to flex his muscles and threaten new military interventions. In general, Eurocrats have leverage over countries that want to join the EU, but Russia has no such ambitions. It considers itself too big and powerful to need to join such a club. That leaves Russia where it wants to be, on the outside, but, by and large, calling the shots. This is Stephen Castle in Brussels.
Now that's just about all the time we have this week. But before we go, an update on our story on North Korea's nuclear test, which was confirmed as such this week. The United Nations Security Council voted unanimously last week to impose sanctions against North Korea, but some analysts have questioned the wisdom behind the resolution and are asking if this is the best method to deal with the Hermit Kingdom. One of the vocal critics is Sweden's Hans Blix, former chief weapons inspector in Iraq and now chairman of the Independent Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. Speaking on the line from New York, he tells Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros that he sees the United Nations Security Council's sanctions as understandable, but hardly advisable.
North Korea usually responds in a very belligerent manner to any threats of sanctions. They are pressed, they escalate. And if you were to have, say, interception of North Korean ships on the high seas, there could very well be a risk of shooting, and then one may not know where it ends. And I see these sanctions as an understandable reaction by countries frustrated by the North Korean attitudes, and also response to public opinion, so certainly in Japan and in the United States. But the U.S. and other countries have been following another line, not that of waving sticks, but rather of providing carrots to the North Koreans.
So your argument is, as far as the international community is concerned, a policy of confrontation with North Korea will not work?
There is a big risk in it. They just adopted a resolution that is very harsh, except that the contents of the sanctions are not so remarkable. They are economic and there are various reservations. I think it's unlikely, when you see the pattern of behavior in North Korea, that they would accept this resolution. And they're already talking about it as a declaration of war.
And how likely is it that they will go ahead with a second test?
I don't think it's at all unlikely. I mean, if they have one explosive device, they probably have more, because if the first one hadn't gone off, they probably have another one in reserve. I think it's quite possible that they'll do that, and it would be completely in style if they did it. If they are subjected to harsh condemnations, then it's very likely that they will go ahead and do a second one.
Sweden's Hans Blix, former chief weapons inspector in Iraq and now chairman of the Independent Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, speaking to us there. And as always, if you'd like to listen to this program again, you can by logging on to our new website at www.networkeurope.org. You'll also find information there on how you can subscribe to our podcast. We love to get feedback on our programs from our listeners. You can send your comments, suggestions, ideas and criticisms to our email address, contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. Now, next week, we're planning a program on what Europeans fear most, be it global warming, nuclear war, or just plain ghosts. We'd like to hear what you think. Drop us a line to that same address and tell us what you're scared of. The address, it's contact@networkeurope.org. We'd like to know what you fear most. Time's up for today. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back next week. In the meantime, I leave you in the capable hands of Swedish band Hedningarna, The Heathens, with Gorlaus. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Mark Cummins. Thanks for joining us.